Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Magazine on November 19th, 2023. My name is Bill McCann, and I'll read a featured story, Russell Brand's Alternate Reality. The British entertainer built an army of fans with his conspiracy-minded podcast. Now, amid sex assault claims against him, they've become his whole world. Right next to the headline of the story is there's a picture, almost cartoonish in some ways, of Russell Brand with his eyes wide open, bearded, some gray in there, and one shoulder it shows him green with a serpent's tongue coming out that's bright red, and on the other his hands are up in the air, and he's surrounded by fire and multiple green faces of his face around him. It's a microphone. It's a strange picture. This is a story by Matt Flegenheimer. On September 12th, 4 days before he was expected at the Troubadour Wembley Park Theater for another sold-out show, Russell Brand asked his fans for a favor. "I've always struggled with authority and being told what to do," he wrote to ticket holders, attaching a questionnaire for a planned bit with his audience. "Even when it comes to something small like being offered a seat by a doctor, I'll purposely refuse rather than comply. Tell me about your relationship with authority, whether you tend to yield to authority or fight it." At the time, Brand's more than two-decade quest for lasting attention has been proceeding apace along two tracks. In mainstream entertainment circles, at home and abroad, he remains the fading but still bankable British comedian whose selectively confessional accounts of heroin addiction and promiscuity made him an avatar of a very mind-aught sort of fame. The guy who played a rocker version of himself in the 2008 film Forgetting Sarah Marshall and would later marry Katy Perry. It was brief. But for those partial to Brand's midlife canon, he had come to resemble something more like a political sage. With Jesus-length hair, multi-denominational tattoos, and promises of unspecified revolution, Brand, 48, had in recent years been reaching millions daily across a media and wellness empire, fusing the downward-facing dogmatism of a proper guru with the cold efficiency of the YouTube algorithm. His remit was nothing less than a social, political, spiritual movement, he told listeners. His prime offering was a trove of foreboding and regularly misleading videos from his flagship series, Stay Free with Russell Brand, lobbed at a cumulative social media following of more than 20 million. His episode titles charted the ideological swerve of a man who once used his celebrity to elevate progressive causes. State of Fear, COVID Propaganda Exposed, Leaked Audio Proves Trump Right. For the past year, Brand's recording studio in the Oxfordshire countryside has been blessed as an emerging nerve center of the American right, or at least the anti-right, with a procession of presidential candidates beaming in. In July alone, Brand interviewed Ron DeSantis, who compared Brand favorably to loathsome corporate journalists, hyped a pull-up contest with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., conservative media's favorite lapsed Democrat and COVID conspiracy theorist, and scored the first sit-down with Tucker Carlson after the host's dismissal from Fox News. "Maybe I've just been called a right-wing crazy for so long that I thought I was," Carlson told me recently. "But if I agree with pretty much everything Russell Brand says, I don't know what I am." Like Joe Rogan, the carnivorous poobah of this intellectual space, Brand appeared interested in teaching a certain kind of man how to be a certain kind of man, mining the tension between think-for-yourself riffs and listen-to-me conclusions. Brand has been a repeat guest on Rogan's podcast. Unlike Rogan, he appears to model a more expansive vision of manhood. Vegan, sober, Aldous Huxley quoting. The event in Wembley, part of a tour scheduled for late summer and early fall, seemed designed to accentuate Brand's overlapping profiles. Electric live performer and terminally online click hunter. As with much of his output lately, the marketplace would help dictate his direction. The tour was called Bipolarization for two reasons, he joked, because people would be polled and because I'm severely mentally ill. His September email to attendees requested answers to several related prompts. What's the strangest way you've yielded to or gone against authority? The first question read, what's the weirdest, naughtiest, most embarrassing thing you've done in reaction to being told what to do? Another asked. 3 days later, Brand's followers received a less whimsical communication. In a pre-bottled video posted across his social media, Brand said he was about to face very serious allegations that I absolutely refute without detailing them. He insisted that all past relationships were consensual. He darkly suggested that another agenda might be at play, noting that supporters had long warned him about getting too close to the truth. The next day, September 16th, Sunday Times, the Times of London, and Channel 4 dispatches published a years-long joint investigation in which four women accused Brand of sexual assault between 2006 and 2013. The accounts were specific, revolting, and in some cases bolstered by medical records and other contemporaneous evidence. The accusers included a woman who was 16, the British age of consent, during her relationship with Brand, who was in his early 30s. She said Brand once forced her to perform oral sex as she strained to push him off, stopping only after she punched him in the stomach. There was a time, as recently as a few years ago, when this sort of reputational earthquake almost certainly would have followed the dutiful rhythms of celebrity crisis management. Performative introspection, nominal contrition, often paired with a narrow denial of the most grievous offenses, a pledge to disappear for a while. Instead, Brand's story quickly became a self-evident data point in two divergent realities. In the first, the one still tethered at least somewhat to traditional notions of scandal and consequence, Brand was an overnight pariah and criminal suspect. The police in London opened investigations. More women came forward, including an extra on Brand's 2011 film Arthur, who filed a civil suit in New York claiming that Brand assaulted her in a bathroom on set. Brand's management company almost immediately dropped him. YouTube suspended him from making money from his channel, which has more than 6 million subscribers. A paramilitary committee chairwoman wrote to Rumble, the video platform that caters to the right and exclusively carries Brand's full episodes, shorter clips still appear on YouTube, expressing concern that he might continue to profit there and undermine the welfare of victims. In the second reality, the victim was Brand, and his welfare was suddenly the concern of many, from the powerful new friends he's made to the awakening wonders as he addresses his flock, refusing to abandon him. His example has become a repentance-free case study in a very 2023 template for public survival, a post-post hashtag MeToo lesson in the spoils and fortifications available to those who are thought to be scorned by the right people. Criticize the drug companies, question the war in Ukraine, and you can be pretty sure this is going to happen, Carlson said of Brand on X, formerly Twitter, to which Elon Musk, the site's Reply guy owner responded, "Sure seems that way." Rumble also posted on X, calling the paramilitary letter a deeply inappropriate intrusion of the state. Already, for those who support Brand and those who don't, his fate is being processed as a kind of referendum on who gets to decide what happens to the accused, on what a preternaturally charismatic figure can talk himself into or out of, on the limits or limitlessness of tribal loyalty. Though the balance of his live tour was scrapped within days, Brand kept one last date, September 16th, in Wembley, hours after the allegations landed. "You came," he said to a crowd of about 2,000, according to the BBC, walking out to "You Don't Own Me," the feminist standard performed by Leslie Gore. He told his guests he loved them, talked about teaching his young children to be skeptical. One fan held a sign reading, "We stand by you." Another threatened to kick down a ladder carrying paparazzi outside. And by the end of the night, the room had a new answer to Brand's pre-show queries. How had they most memorably snubbed authority? How had they responded when told what to do and think? With a standing ovation for a freshly accused predator. More than a week after the allegations, Stay Free returned, unbowed, but discernibly altered. Brand appeared alone, his bare chest visible beneath a largely unbuttoned white button-down. The show credits, which ran about 20 names deep, were gone, not necessarily because Brand's whole team was, but perhaps because associating with him had become more complicated. The corporatist state and global media war against free speech is in full swing, Brand told his listeners. How do I know? Take a guess. Seated at a desk with a Daily Show-style prosecutorial montage of videos and text, Brand blamed the, quote, collusion between big tech and government and a, quote, centrist state and globalist elite that he suggests was persecuting him. He discussed the letter from Parliament, alleging ties between its author and Google, a competitor to Rumble. He welcomed Jimmy Dore, another conspiracy theory-minded comedian podcaster, for a remote interview, thanking him for a mood lift, quote, at a time where I plainly need it. Stay strong, Dore said. This booking choice was notable. Dore, who has himself been accused of sexual harassment, is among a cluster of high-profile Brand supporters who seem particularly invested in the idea that false or agenda-led accusations are an occupational hazard for their lot. Andrew Tate, the misogynist mega-influencer awaiting trial on rape and human trafficking charges in Romania, tagged Brand on X, "Welcome to the club." Donald Trump Jr., whose father has been serially accused, posted a meme on Instagram showing the former president, Brand, Tate, and Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, who was accused of rape. Notice a pattern? The meme read alongside Trump Jr.'s caption, "One day they'll be coming for you. I don't believe in this much coincidence, and neither should you." For Brand's audience, long encouraged to consider his voice too dangerous for entrenched interests to abide, the allegations stand as proof of concept, only making him more credible. "Enough of us know what's going on here," one commenter assured him upon his return. "No wonder they're trying to silence you," another posted on an October video that criticized President Biden. "It's almost like cancel capital," Nick Marks, a professor of film and media studies at Colorado State University and the co-author of a book on right-wing comedy, told me. "It's something he recognizes as having a value distinct from money. With Trumpian verve, Brand has reframed accusations against him as an act of war against everyone who backs him. "They're out to get you," he told his audience in November, citing censorial forces like YouTube and quoting from Kafka's The Trial. "I'm just in the way." Like the former president, Brand has channeled lessons from his early rise, betting on his basest self, and on the accommodations and calculations that those around him have always made. Since his public beginnings, Brand has derived his power from appearing to get away with something, from saying and doing what others never would. His fame was entwined with an almost ostentatious misogyny, a sizzle reel of mistreated women and gleefully poor taste for which he was broadly celebrated. His best-selling 2007 memoir relayed such rollicking tales as breaking the phone of a Turkish sex worker mid-encounter because the ringing bothered him. The British tabloid The Sun saluted him as its Shagger of the Year from 2006 to 2008. A breezy 2008 GQ profile winked at the souvenir that Brand acquired at a photo shoot. Her name is Penny, and shared an anecdote from another romantic partner who claimed he told her, "I'm Russell Brand. I can do anything I like." Brand denied this semantically. "That may be the informing attitude," he told the magazine, "but that's never explicitly stated." There's a picture after that of him with Katy Perry, to whom he was briefly married. Even scandal generally served Brand's ends. 2008, he and a co-host set off a national uproar after broadcasting on Brand's BBC radio show the prankish voice messages they left for Andrew Sachs, a beloved former actor on Fawlty Towers. Sachs's granddaughter, Georgiana Bailey, was in a relationship with Brand in her early 20s. The messages to Sachs included sing-songy Brand lyrics. It was consensual, and she wasn't menstrual. Suspensions followed. Gordon Brown, the sitting prime minister, scolded him. Brand eventually resigned. His cad for the masses legend grew anyway. "He was being very much rewarded," Bally, now 38, told me. "Didn't even occur to me that I deserved an apology." In interviews, people who know Brand described him to me as someone almost pathologically incapable of not having an audience and willing to do virtually anything to keep it. He's often admitted as much, joking that he could be whatever his followers wanted. "Are you unapologetically yourself?" he asked in August. "Because I'm not. I'm apologetically myself. Hello, I'm me. Is this okay with everyone? I can change if you want." Brand and a longtime associate didn't respond to an interview request or fact-checking queries. In the 2008 GQ piece, Brand identified one clear gift, attracting attention, and warned playfully that his wider influence should be curbed. "I don't think for a minute that I should be the person that comes up with how we organize a new post-apocalyptic order," he said, "because I think I'd exploit it to get girls." When Brand speaks now about forging a new social order, he attributes his rise as a media force, accurately enough, to a collapse of faith in traditional institutions. Left unsaid is that Brand himself was a creation of legacy gatekeepers and their customers, the media companies that employed him, the outlets that toasted him, the viewers who couldn't resist, and a leering testament to their priorities. What has lingered for some lately is not how so many people missed the signs about him, but why they seem so eager to ignore them. In recent months, two former employers, the BBC and Channel 4, announced internal inquiries into Brand's past workplace behavior. Channel 4, where Brand was accused of flashing a female colleague, aired the investigative documentary about him in September. Its title, In Plain Sight. It was this wash of devil may care, it's exciting to push boundaries or just have no boundaries, and women were less than. Shaparak Khorsandi, an early peer of Brand's on the comedy circuit, told me of the era that made him. Yet a man behaving absolutely appallingly was given endless television and radio contracts. The subject of the day in December 2014 was immigration, and the lineup for a BBC political panel was suitably formidable. A conservative member of parliament, another from Labour, a Sunday Times columnist, but two combatants stood out. Nigel Farage, then the leader of the UK Independence Party, reprising his argument that new entrants to Britain were a dangerous resource drain, and Brand. There is a corrupt group in our country using our resources, taking away our jobs, taking away our housing, not paying taxes, Brand agreed. But it was the economic elite funding Farage's party. His mates in the city farted, Brand continued. Farage was pointing at immigrants and holding his nose. The studio audience roared. Raised as a working-class bloke, in his frequent telling, Brand had long angled to amplify his voice on the left, infusing early appearances with sometimes deliberately shocking allusions to global affairs. He's delighted in claiming that on September 12, 2001, while employed as a presenter at British MTV, he showed up at work dressed as Osama bin Laden. The following spring, he was detained by the police after fully disrobing at a protest in Piccadilly Circus, explaining himself by mentioning ecological, Armageddon, and culture without making a great deal of sense, according to the news report from the time. Oh God, an MTV spokesman said then, that sounds like Russell. Even before he was famous, he sort of fancied himself a bit of a Che Guevara, Khorsandi told me. After he was famous, Brand expanded his political footprint proportionally. To 2012, he was invited to testify before a parliamentary committee on drug policy, walking the halls in a black tank top and bolero hat. Same year, he developed a short-lived talk show for American TV, FX's Brand X with Russell Brand. Appeared with Matt Stoller, liberal policy researcher. The men met while Brand was shooting Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which Stoller's brother Nicholas directed. They reconnected in 2011 at the Occupy Wall Street protest at Zuccotti Park in New York. They wanted to do a more radical version of The Daily Show, Stoller told me of Brand X in August. It was a bad show. Brand's political breakthrough came in a viral BBC interview in 2013 with Jeremy Paxman, one of Britain's most fearsome questioners. Paxman appraised Brand as a trivial man whose call for revolution and apathy about voting gave him away. You spent your whole career berating and haranguing politicians, Brand responded. Then when someone like me, a comedian, goes, yeah, they're all worthless, what's the point in engaging with any of them? You sort of have to go at me because I'm not poor anymore. The exchange enshrined Brand as perhaps the nation's foremost lefty. It had a massive impact, George Monbiot, a well-known environmentalist and writer, told me. It galvanized people. It galvanized me. In short order, Brand was hailed as a kind of crossover intellectual, validated by authors and thinkers who schlepped to his East London home to appear on his popular YouTube series, The Trues, a portmanteau of true and news. Academics said they could become entranced by Brand's free associative conviction on their subjects, even when he sounded almost semi-sensical, absorbing the quick-draw wit and baroque vocabulary of a host liable to deploy perspicacity or effulgent off the cuff. I actually remember thinking at the time, oh, this is how a new religion would start, Edward Slingerland, an expert on ancient Chinese thought, now teaching at the University of British Columbia, told me of their interview. For activists, Brad became a treasured ally, showing up at rallies to oppose austerity, protect tenants, support firefighters, and invariably attracting cameras. He also began ingratiating himself with more mainstream politicos, at one point initiating a correspondence with Bill de Blasio, whose 2013 mayoral victory in New York had briefly stirred the left. "I do remember thinking of him as a fellow traveler," de Blasio told me. 2015, Ed Miliband, then the Labour Party's leader, made a pilgrimage to Brand's home for the web series, hoping to reach younger voters within its seven-figure following. Both men came to rue their choices. "Obviously, knowing what I know now, I regret doing it," Miliband said after the assault allegations. Brand's second thoughts arrived sooner, when his imprimatur could not prevent a conservative election triumph. "My only regret," he said afterward, "is I thought I could be involved." If Brand felt disillusioned, he was not alone on the British left. "They used Russell," Monbiot said of Labour, "but they never embraced him. Brand has since resolved to live beyond all political systems." Among one-time admirers, the most generous interpretation for Brand's political transformation is bleak but straightforward. Today's version of him is the logical upshot of social media incentives, boundless ego, and a bespoke personal radicalism that was always a little ominously amorphous. "I don't know how to describe Russell's politics," Marianne Williamson told me in August, warmly recounting the fundraiser he helped host for her during the 2020 Democratic presidential primary. "In this reading, Brand is simply who we told him to be, or at least what the algorithm did. He's been known to track his trend lines on social media obsessively, staying apprised of follower counts and video performance. A job posting on Brand's website earlier this year for a YouTube optimizer was bracingly explicit. The task," this is a quote, "the task was to juice viewership and propose topics based upon topics covered by similar channels and those that our audience watch. This is the path from interviewing favored commentators of the right, like Ben Shapiro or Jordan Peterson, to having those videos recommended to fans of Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson to sound increasingly like Ben Shapiro and Jordan Peterson. You can either try to drive the masses or be driven by them," Fez Shakir, the 2020 campaign manager for Bernie Sanders, told me after appearing on Brand's show in August to push his labor-supporting nonprofit. "He's more driven by them. It's, here's where I think they already are." Brand has said that at least half his viewers are in the United States. After he interviewed DeSantis last summer, a person close to the campaign's decision-making told me the host was seen as a conduit to men under 45, especially those who were not lifelong Republicans. On air, Brand can sound occasionally uncomfortable with his new constituency. Last year, he pressed Peterson to prioritize compassion rather than antagonize trans people. In the otherwise slobbering session with DeSantis, Brand almost begged him to agree that imposing an ideology on others was illiberal. "What about the freedom of those opposed?" Brand asked, but such flashes have been rare. 2015, Brand called Trump a joke whose punchline is a worse world for everyone. By this February, he was posing with Trump Jr. at a Rumble event in Florida. He once quoted Gandhi on nonviolent protest. Now he mocks those clutching their pearls over January 6th. Jeff Krasno, former manager of Brand's, suggested on his own podcast in September that Brand has by now likely drunk his own kombucha, adding, there's a clear business rationale for the content that Russell generates. On stage, Brand has prided himself on a thrill-seeking gameness. You have to be truthful and honest, he said of his comedy, self-aware and willing to take risks. Yet in many ways, Brand's reinvention was exceedingly safe. He would be rewarded for playing the hits, for doing the expected. He would be cancel-proofed, if it came to it, with an army of backers primed to distrust anyone who attacked him. This is the less charitable read on Brand's evolution. His alt-rightward drift and his escalating insistence that mainstream outlets were corrupt agents of the status quo has coincided roughly with the investigative journalism of mainstream outlets he now calls corrupt agents of the status quo. According to the Times of London, the reporting began in 2019, and Brand's team was made aware of one assault allegation in 2020. In the years since, Brand has been setting himself up more and more as the lone voice of truth. Manbiet, Brand's former progressive ally, told me, it would definitely align with an attempt then to exonerate himself using the same argument. Even privately, though, Brand's orbit seems increasingly paranoid. After the allegations were made public, Brand's father, Ron, wrote to Manbiet, who previously criticized Brand's political shifts, to suggest that no one was safe from whatever plot had ensnared his son. Do you think you could be next? Ron Brand asked, according to messages Manbiet shared with me. The elder Brand later sent a conspiracy video about the World Health Organization and the World Economic Forum, two favorite targets for Brand and others who use globalists unironically. Tucker Carlson, who said that he and Brand have been speaking often, told me the allegations against Brand were inevitable, suspicious, and cynically engineered to play on the debauched past of a man who is now remarried with children. We're leaving the part of history where people try to persuade each other in good faith, Carlson said. We're entering the part where we just throw our opponents in jail or accuse them of crimes. So far, Brand's podcast guests have likewise stayed loyal. In an industry rife with voices insisting they are about to be silenced, loudly saying the things they swear you can't say anymore, Brand represents a rousing spectacle, staying free despite the designs of a sinister they. The cancelers of the world seem, with each passing week, to become more and more crap at their jobs, the writer Matt Taibbi said on Substack in April, promoting his interview with the conspicuously still-breathing Russell Brand. Teasing an interview in November with Alex Jones of InfoWars, who has described the assault allegations against Brand as a vast conspiracy, Brand suggested a kinship. Have you noticed, he said, raising two fingers for scary quotes, how many of the wild Alex Jones conspiracy theories have come to pass? More than anything else, Brand is testing a tantalizing kind of liberty before a group that reveres the word. He's hinted about a financial crunch since YouTube began blocking his profits, telling viewers on Rumble that he is plainly in a position where your direct support is going to be incredibly valuable. But if Brand's strategy is successful, if he can subsist without the institutions that long sustained him, the collaborators who abandon him, the former fans who might wince through his movie scenes now, there's a new kind of power in that freedom, and a new kind of freedom in that power. We're planning a movement so that we can form new communities as the apocalypse apparently unfolds before our very eyes, he told listeners on October 26th. Without you, we are nothing. The episode turned moments later to another aspiring movement leader, Vivek Ramaswamy, a returning guest and the first presidential candidate to appear with Brand after the allegations. Speaking from Iowa mid-campaign, Ramaswamy called for a great uprising against establishment forces. It's when they tell you to shut up that you have to actually grow the spine to be more vocal than ever, he said. I can see why there would be an appetite to censor you, Brand replied admiringly. The host thanked his guest for elevating the caliber of the conversation in his stream of freedom. He previewed future episode subjects, the COVID lab leak theory, another chat with Jordan Peterson, the necessity for radicalism in politics. Then he made a promise. Next week, Brand vowed, raising his open hands, the revolution will grow a little stronger. The author, Matt Flegenheimer, is a reporter covering national politics. He started at the Times in 2011 at the Metro desk covering transit, City Hall, and campaigns. Now I'll read a letter of recommendation. Did Demolition Man predict the millennial? A cult classic saw the future, kind of. Story by Kaber Chibber. Now that we live in the future, we no longer seem to make as many films about the future, at least not the way we once did. When we tried our hardest to imagine a future as different from the present as we were from ancient history. Today, with all kinds of human knowledge in our pockets, we prefer to think of in terms of alternate timelines, paths not taken, the multiverse of infinite possibilities. We're looking sideways, not forward. But for most of the existence of cinema, a glorious near centennial from Metropolis, 1927, to, let's say, Wall-E from 2008, people use celluloid to dream of what lay ahead. Growing up with these movies, I like to keep a mental scorecard concerning which of their futures seemed most likely. I would have hoped that by now we'd be experiencing the vibrant urban chaos of The Fifth Element, but no. What about HAL and the blind faith in technological advancement that connotes progress in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, 1968? Kind of. The computers controlled by constant hand-waving in Steven Spielberg's Minority Report, 2002? Not quite. All of these are classics, but the one that I think got it most right is a 1993 action comedy whose hallmark is a tremendous recurring poop joke. In Demolition Man, a cop named John Spartan, played by Sylvester Stallone, is frozen in 1996 for spurious reasons and thawed out in the year 2032 when Southern California has been merged into an enormous metroplex called San Angeles. He's tasked with hunting down a homicidal maniac, played by a blonde, mugging Wesley Snipes. The joke is that in the future, everyone is kind and gentle to one another. Lenina Huxley, Spartan's 90s loving partner, explains that alcohol, caffeine, contact sports, meat, bad language, and gasoline, among other things, are banned. It has been deemed that anything not good for you is bad, goes the tau of Demolition Man, hence illegal. The movie's pleasure doesn't lie in its plentiful violence. Well, some of it does. It's in the humor that arises from these future San Angelians' disgust over Spartan's primitive ways, like his desire to use guns and to smoke and to have sex the old-fashioned way, rather than through a virtual reality headset. They mock him over the fact that he asks for toilet paper. Everyone now uses something called the three seashells, which is never explained. Spartan is baffled by new technology like the omnipresent Alex-like morality boxes, Alexa-like morality boxes that issue instant fines for offensive language, and kiosks that offer words of affirmation on the streets. You are an incredibly sensitive man who inspires joy feelings in all those around you. Stallone's cop has been subliminally rehabilitated while frozen and wakes up knowing how to knit. I'm a seamstress, he laments. What separates Demolition Man from other sci-fi films of much higher aspiration is that it imagined a future generation who might view our civilization at the peak of its powers as utterly barbaric. We're not quite there, but it feels as if the world that the younger generations loathe is the one I was raised in. And in the process, this has turned the film, at least for me, into an explosive, sometimes vituperative allegory for aging. As Spartan finds out, it hurts to wake up one day and find that the world has moved on without you. Some days I feel like I've woken up from cryo sleep and am looking around to discover that I'm the only one who misses our previous era of casual cynicism and dubious morality and brilliant jerks. Back in the 90s, I sat in the cinema and watched this film like thousands of other people, never imagining that I might one day feel like Spartan. I am living in the future, and I don't belong. Everyone else has moved on. I'm still wiping myself with toilet paper instead of the three seashells. It's a shame that Demolition Man doesn't have more of a place in popular culture. If it has any presence at all, it's through unhinged libertarians online. There's a person on X, for example, who takes inspiration from the film and rants about what he describes as the deranged parallel universe we're in. These types might be more similar to the only people who reject society in the movie, led by a cholesterol-loving Dennis Leary who longs to smoke a cigar the size of Cincinnati in the non-smoking section. They live underground, eating rat burgers. I'm more ambivalent. Newly unthawed, how would I live? I turned to Demolition Man for guidance on how to navigate the future. Most everyone else accepts this timid new world. I can see why. It's very appealing. Everyone is extremely nice. There's no crime. There's the choice of only one restaurant. It's Taco Bell. No conflict is necessary because they've banned everything worth fighting over. If this is where we're heading, it might be better than the past, if not as much fun, infused with a whiff of dystopian. Everyone else seems to have made their accommodations with this future. Why can't I? Perhaps I find this film resonant, not so much because it turned out to be prophetic, but because it reminds me that I once was certain of what the future would look like and my place in it. I think I'm like Spartan, but I'm actually more like a wistful Lenina Huxley, surrounded by 1990s contraband, unable to let go. You're still addicted to the 20th century, another cop admonishes her, high from its harshness. I know how she feels. Kabir Chibber is a writer and filmmaker born in Hong Kong. He lives in New York City. Up until 10 years ago, relatively few things were in orbit around the Earth. So what's in space right now? A story by Charlie Locke. An even more international space station. When China launched the last stage of its space station in October 2022, it opened up low orbit for scientists far beyond its borders. Tiangong has so far agreed to host projects from 12 countries. In May, the first experimental equipment reached the 54-foot-long station. A new moon buggy. In August, with the success of the Chandrayaan-3 mission, India became the fourth country to safely land on the moon following the Soviet Union, United States, and China. The six-wheeled rover Pranyaan explored near the lunar South Pole, where scientists think craters may hold ice. Cooperative communication satellites. More than 80 countries have sent satellites into orbit, including many smaller nations, which often share costs and expertise. Turkmenistan-52E Monaco Sat, a communication satellite built in France and launched from Cape Canaveral, Florida, is shared by Monaco and Turkmenistan. Elon Musk's ever-multiplying satellites. Over 50% of all active satellites, currently about 5,000, are from the Elon Musk-owned company Starlink. Musk plans to eventually have as many as 42,000 of the communications satellites in orbit, the Times reported. Lots and lots of junk. In 2009, a dead Russian satellite, Cosmos 2251, crashed into an operational telecommunications satellite, creating clouds of debris. According to NASA, there are 28,000 pieces of debris in low Earth orbit that are larger than a softball. 500,000 pieces, roughly the size of a marble, and 100,000,000, about the size of a pea. Even paint flecks can damage satellites, space stations, or spacecraft when traveling at 17,500 miles per hour. Autonomous miners. In April 2021, the China-based company Origin Space launched NEO-01, its first robot designed to test asteroid mining capabilities. In April 2023, the startup AstroForge launched a satellite and is now assessing its ability to vaporize and sort an asteroid-like material in orbit. Scientists and their experiments. The International Space Station houses astronauts. Yes, but we're not the only living thing sent into orbit. Scientists on the station completed around 500 experiments from September 2022 to September 2023. They have recently worked with 120 Hawaiian bobtail squid to understand how bacteria interact with their hosts during spaceflight. And they have grown red robin dwarf tomatoes to help develop agricultural methods for long space flights. There's also a non-human member of the current space station crew, Sasha, a stuffed animal three-toed sloth brought as a zero-G indicator. When Sasha started to float in the cabin, the astronauts knew they were entering orbit. Logos, logos, logos. If you looked closely at the iSpace lander as it headed for the moon on April 25th, you might have recognized some shapes emblazoned on its side. The Suzuki S, the crane of Japanese Airlines, the rhombuses of SMBC, a Japanese bank. The age of space advertising is here. Works of art, both huge and extremely tiny. Art in space ranges from the minuscule to the size of spacecraft. 2018, the aerospace manufacturer Rocket Lab sent a reflective geodesic sphere called Humanity Star into orbit. Viewers could see the shining disc ball from Earth. Works from a second grader and a fourth grader in Florida will soon head into orbit as winners of the state's Space Art Contest. In December, the Lunar Codex, a collection featuring works from over 30,000 artists, will launch its first set of more than 5,000 prints, songs, stories, poems, and firms and films to the sinus viscostatus region of the moon via an astrobotic mission lander. The artwork is digitized and miniaturized into tiny images, which are imprinted onto a piece of nickel-based nanofiche the size of a dime. Drug labs. Commercial drug manufacturing is often easier in microgravity because protein crystals grown in space tend to form more uniform structures than those grown on Earth. This year, Bristol-Myers Squibb led an experiment on the ISS to crystallize medications. The startup, Varda Space Industries, launched its first spacecraft in July to test crystal production of Ritonavir, an antiviral HIV drug. Robotic space planes. The United States and China currently have reusable robotic spacecraft regularly in orbit. Two X-37Bs, built by Boeing and operated by the U.S. Space Force, and a vehicle believed to be operated by the Chinese Ministry of National Defense. Combined, the two X-37B craft have flown six times in space since 2010, most recently landing after 908 days in November 2022. Telescopes, not called Webb or Hubble. There are several telescopes in Earth orbit answering urgent questions about the universe. The IXPE, or Imaging X-ray Polarimetry Explorer, observes some of the most expensive extreme objects in our universe, like supernova explosions or jet streams shot from black holes, to learn how they work. Charlie Locke, who wrote this, is a writer who often covers youth and elders. Since she last wrote for the magazine about pandemic funding and public education. And I'll end with Judge John Hodgman on Thanksgiving gift boxes. Paul writes, "My wife and I host American Thanksgiving in Toronto. We give our guests small gift boxes. Lately, my wife has been buying and wrapping extra gifts that don't fit in the box. I say, this is too much." And the judge writes, "People often remind us that the beauty standards espoused by influencers are unrealistic and damaging. Someone should do the same for Thanksgiving, a familial stress and guilt machine. A long weekend in November? Great. Let's ruin it with historical revisionism, Sisyphean travel, and the cruel prank that is trying to cook a turkey evenly. And you've added gifts? We have a big money-wasting bric-a-brac swap coming right up. Why do this to yourself? As you might say in Canada, hey, humbug. Still, I bet if you invited me, my crankiness would evaporate, and I would thank you. But if I get any gift outside of that little box, I'm going to stuff it in your bird. The box is plenty."
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org or by calling 303-786-7777.